We'll move on to the rest of our agenda, and we are at regular agenda item 226.
Allow city-subsidized affordable housing projects to utilize a Type 2X land use review procedure pursuant to PCC 33.730.025 for the duration of the housing emergency.
Commissioner Saltzman.
Thank you, Mayor. This resolution, oh, could you read the ordinance too, Carla?
Can we do them both? Go ahead and read 227 too also.
Thank yeah.
You. 227. Direct the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to develop a legislative proposal to amend Title 33 as part of Regulatory Improvement Code Amendment Package, RICAP number 8, to simplify regulations, remove regulatory obstacles, and expedite processes for land use reviews and permits for affordable housing projects, mass shelters, and short-term housing.
Thank you. Thanks, Carla. This resolution and ordinance will further the City Council's commitment to addressing our affordable housing emergency. It also represents one of the many collaborative outcomes between the Housing Bureau and the Bureau of Development Services to expand our city stock of affordable housing. And I'd like to thank Mayor Hills for his support of these efforts and his co-sponsorship of these items. And the resolution directs the Planning Bureau to conduct a legislative process to identify other opportunities to increase affordable housing through the land use process. And the ordinance establishes a new type of review process for affordable housing projects only. And here to explain more is our Housing Director, Kurt Krieger, and Development Services Director, Paul Scarlett, and Rebecca Esau is here always to keep us honest, keep us on tack. So please take it away.
Very good. Thank you very much, Commissioner Saltzman, Mr. Mayor, members of council. My name is Kurt Krieger, and I'd like to at least remind you that on September 15th, the council had a study session on what we termed at that time the high cost of affordable housing. We invited five expert witnesses to join me in that panel conversation: Michael Parkhurst from the Meyer Memorial Trust, Jessica Woodruff, the Reach Community Development Corporation's development director, Jill Sherman, a partner with Gurdy Nettleton Development, David Carboneau, a private developer and principal in Home First Development, and Mike Steffen, the general manager of Walsh Construction. We're all here. And just to refresh your memory and for the record, we evaluated all the current data as it related to housing prices of affordable housing, and we were able to isolate the cost drivers of affordable housing. Some 77% of the costs were hard costs. That is land, building, and labor, principally. 14% of the cost of affordable housing was in what we call soft costs. That's architecture and engineering fees, it's interest, it's taxes, legal expenses, and the like. And 9% are what we termed at that time social benefit costs. And social benefit costs is a basket of goods that are, in fact, applied by local government or state government to achieve social aims as a part of the development. Those include design review. And that conversation that we had on September 15th was an open, frank conversation about ways in which we could improve and bend the cost curve by specifically looking at the social benefit costs. Those are within your purview as policymakers. Design review was identified as a potential area for three principal concerns. One was that there was no time certain by which a project ever exits design review. There are design guidelines, and BDS will describe those to you, but projects were going into design review, recommended changes were made, they would come back, the applicants would come back with having made those recommended changes, and more recommended changes were then made. So there seemed to be sort of an interminable feedback loop that was created in that process, which was created uncertainty and added costs. The second, speaking of costs, is that while the design standards that are created by planning and sustainability are embedded in policy, there is no cost consideration. The Design Commission is not tasked with that job. And so there was a debate about the type of materials without an offsetting conversation about what those materials actually cost. And I'd be happy to talk specifically about some examples about costs that were added as a part of design review. The third issue that seemed to be an issue was one of standing, and that is that these projects all are in a physical location. They have neighborhood interests, but the record is open for anyone to come comment as a design critic, and many do, that are not necessarily vested in the specific outcomes of a specific project. They may not be property owners. They may not be neighbors even of the locality, but they're given equal standing, which creates a lot of uncertainty for applicants. So during the discussion that we had last fall, Caritas, which is the nonprofit associated with the Archdiocese of Portland, had a project at St. Francis Parish. It's called St. Francis Park. They are co-developing that with Home Forward. And the project underwent design review. The exterior cladding of the building was changed as a result of design review, and the project cost $400,000 more as a result. It did get processed within the prescribed time, so it wasn't delayed unnecessarily, but the costs are real. And it's important that you realize that this is a project that's funded by the Portland Housing Bureau, so those cost overages are essentially paid for by public funds. We are respectful that the design commissioners and their cohorts, the landmark commissioners, are citizens. They're giving of their time freely. They're very thoughtful, and they're very deliberative. So it's not to diminish sort of the value added, but to put it in perspective, to recognize that we do have a housing emergency and that the changes recommended to you today are, in effect, a way by which to beta test in a short term between now and this fall process improvements that could result in more affordable housing more quickly. I can go into more detail, but I'd like Paul to talk a little bit about the specifics.
Thank you, Kurt. Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. Paul Scarlett, Director for Bureau of Development Services. I'll just share a couple of summary remarks, and I'll turn it over to Rebecca to go into more details about the difference between what's proposed, Type 2X, and existing requirement Type 3. First, we are very supportive of the efforts that the city is involved in addressing the housing emergency and working very closely and collaboratively with the Portland Housing Bureau and staff to address and come up with processes and efficiencies to allow for these projects to be built and completed. One of the proposal that is in front of you is one that was identified as a way to speed up the process, to reduce delay, and also to reduce cost. The Type 2X is one that would allow for staff administrative process decision versus going to a public hearing. And so that in itself would save time and money. As Kurt said, we are appreciative of the members of the Historic Landmarks and the Design Commission. This is in no way reflective of the work they're doing or not doing. It's in response to an emergency. And how can we get housing that are city subsidized, located in Central City and the Gateway, through the development review and land use review process quicker. And so through conversation and deliberation, this is a tool that's been identified. We feel it will be beneficial in a lot of ways. It will run the course of the declaration through October. And we are looking and will be partnering with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability on how this could be maybe a more permanent process. That's through the resolution, which they kind of work in conjunction with each other. Just an example for fees differences. In the Type 3, which these fees are based on project valuation, and so if you're building an apartment building, the cost of the project stipulates the type or the amount of review fee. So a Type 3 ranges from about $9,000 to $31,000. That includes BDS fees, the infrastructure bureau fees to review these projects. Type 2X would reduce that amount down to $5,000 to $9,000 on the high end. That's a savings of about $4,000 to $22,000. That's huge. And, of course, the timelines varies as well. So just to give you a little bit of context of some of the differences, Rebecca, our land use division manager, is, of course, more astute with all the technicalities of the differences in the land use review processes and policies and so forth. So I'll turn it over to her. Thank you.
I would like to emphasize that in no way are we lowering the standards or the bar of what we expect as far as design and design quality. The regulations are staying the same as far as the approval criteria and the design guidelines that apply. It's only the procedure that we're using to review those projects that is proposed to be changed from a Type 3 to a 2X. And the basic differences between those review procedures, a Type 3 requires a mandatory hearing. The hearing is required to take place within 51 days of a complete application. For a Type 2X, there is no hearing. It's a staff-level decision, and the decision needs to be made within 42 days of a complete application. It only goes to a hearing if it's appealed, and that would be to the Design Commission or the Landmarks Commission. If a Type 3 is appealed, it goes to City Council. And the way this ordinance is drafted is it's an option for an applicant. They can still choose to use the Type 3 design review process if they want to, which preserves their right to then have an appeal that goes to City Council if they want to get to you. But they have the option to use the 2X instead and get through the process more quickly.
And where does the 2X get appealed to?
If it's a design review, it'll be appealed to the Design Commission, and if it's a historic resource review, to the Historic Landmarks Commission. And if those hearings bodies, then if their decision is appealed, it goes to LUBA. It never comes to City Council.
So there is still the potential for a hearing before a public body in the City of Portland?
Yes.
With the 2X?
Yes.
Perhaps to animate the conversation a little bit, this requires projects to be publicly funded through the Portland Housing Bureau. And so it's a narrow window of opportunity. We looked at our pipeline as to projects that we've underwritten, who are currently in design development, and who are at the stage of development, which this would provide them with an option. Neither have decided whether or not to take the 2X, but I think it's important that you know who they are and what they are. The 14th and Raleigh property that is owned by the Portland Housing Bureau has been assigned to Innovative Housing, Inc. as the master developer. They've developed a plan for 93 units in a 12-story building. Of those, 44 units, or 47%, are for people between 0 to 30% of median income, so it's extremely low income. The design architect is Alex Salazar, and the architect of record is LRS Architecture. They currently have had design advice consultations with staff. They have not yet gone through the formal process. The second option, which is also viable in the current time frame, is River Place Parcel 3, which is also owned by the Portland Housing Bureau. We've assigned the development rights of that project to a team of Bridge Housing and Williams and Dame Development. It is a mixed-income property of 203 affordable units and 162 market rate units with approximately 31,000 square foot of retail in the South Waterfront area. Of those, 90 units are 44%, or for people between 0 and 30% of median income. So both have an extreme amount of public value. They're both in strategic locations, one's in the Pearl, one's in the South Waterfront. And I must say that both developers have already engendered conversations with the immediate affected neighborhoods about project design. So whichever process they select, this will not be news to any of the neighborhood residents because they've already had multiple meetings on this.
And the design guidelines in the Central City and Gateway remains, and these projects are required to meet those guidelines. So that doesn't change.
And one more piece of the ordinance, the Type 2X, as part of this ordinance, would require that the applicant apply for a design advice request. This is a form of early assistance to ensure that the applicant, before they spend a lot of time working on their design, they can bring their conceptual design to the Design Commission or the Historic Landmarks Commission to get feedback on the conceptual design, as well as get information from the infrastructure bureaus about what requirements apply, similar to a pre-application conference. So there's no surprises later on that could cost a lot of money and time.
Here, I have a few questions.
Questions. Go ahead, please.
Has this concept been floated by the DRAC or Landmarks or Planning Sustainability?
Or Design Commission.
Or Design Commission. Are any of the our advisory bodies that normally weigh in on this, have they been asked to comment?
Yes, and we have letters from both the Design Commission and the Historic Landmarks Commission that was just handed right before I came up, so I haven't had a chance to read that, but I've heard that they do have some concerns about this. And I'm not sure if you're taking testimony today, but they are here.
I met with some design commissioners and landmark commissioner yesterday, too, about this.
All right. So has there been a formal presentation at DRAC, at Landmarks, or at the Design Commission about this proposal?
They both reviewed the proposed ordinances, and they both commented on them. Housing Bureau did not make a formal presentation, but they seem to be fully conversant about the effect of the policies. We'd be happy to respond to questions perhaps after their testimony.
I haven't received any feedback from any of the oversight bodies, but I guess we now have a letter and we'll have some testimony, so we'll get a chance to hear that. Mr. Director, would you remind me again, what's the trigger for which kinds of projects, is eligible for this expedited process?
Well, there are a couple of threshold requirements. They must be directly subsidized by the Portland Housing Bureau. That means they must have received a financial commitment from the Bureau. In both of the instances I gave you, we have done so. It happens that we also own both of the underlying sites, so we're even more deeply embedded in those projects. It would not apply, for instance, to a project indirectly assisted by the city through a tax exemption.
Well, you beat me to it. So that's important. So if it's a project that qualifies for a multi-tax abatement or something, that would not be eligible.
Not under this current iteration, although the second of these two companions requests Planning and Sustainability to come back with a permanent ordinance, they could choose to examine the indirect assistance provided.
I think they're qualitatively different. I would at least need to know more. I'd have to have a deeper conversation. You've in your presentation, you've been very clear that there's no dilution of design standards. And I want to pick up on that for a second, because one of the noteworthy things about city-owned or city-invested affordable housing is that it is typically not what communities rail against. That is, when you hear from folks in East Portland about crappy housing that is not designed in a way that's sensitive or respectful of the community, it is often the private market housing that's been slapped up and that looks like if a good windstorm comes, it'll be knocked down. Some of the most durable, long-term, and beautiful housing is the housing that the city has partnered with a nonprofit developer to build, and I can give you 1,000 examples. So can you ensure us, and by the way, I think that when we're using public dollars to invest in affordable housing, we should approach that just like we're building a public library or a transportation hub or anything else. I think we should take great pride in creating a space that's functional and also that is a community amenity. And even if you disagree with that on aesthetic grounds, I will tell you that the community buy-in and the community acceptance goes through the roof when it's something that people are proud of. And if you don't even accept that, I will tell you that better design, better built buildings last longer. So from a taxpayer point of view, we can say that there's a return. And the problem with not getting it right at the front end is there's no going back. And there's a certain building at the bridgehead that reminds me of that every day I go to work. We can't demolish that building, but it's an eyesore, and it's not what was intended. So can you ensure us during this pilot project that there will be no dilution of the kinds of existing and sensible design standards which help us produce functional as well as attractive buildings?
I think we both probably need to respond.
You just need to say yes.
I definitely want to affirm your statement that affordable housing is not inferior housing. We don't need to cut corners with respect to the durability of materials or amenities. What we build today will last 100 years, and we need to be thinking in that regard. What I do want to underscore is that in addition to having direct financing, the projects must be five or more units. We selected that five-unit threshold because that is the HUD standard for multifamily housing. Four or fewer units is regarded as single-family in the HUD lexicon. Five or more is multifamily. And the incomes must be below 60% of median income. So this at least differentiates between projects that might be more than 60, although the two examples that I gave you are well under that.
I think what you said is important because we're talking about the public purpose, but we're still, I'm still focused on making sure that we, while we potentially cut red tape and create certainty, we're not degrading the kind of quality standards that people expect when they when a development comes to their community.
And I'll let Paul and Rebecca follow up.
Sure. That was a good question and concern. BDS is focused on reviewing projects that or for sure meeting the development standards, the design guideline. We would be looking at affordable housing similar as we would in private development and making sure those requirements are being met. That's the passion and the professional approach from all staff working in the design and historic section. So that's something we can commit to because that's what we do. And I believe you can be assured that that's what we would be doing in this case.
You said there were potentially three answers. Are we all in accord on that?
As I said earlier, we have no intention of lowering the bar on the design standards, and we would hold them to the same standard we currently hold all Type 3 and type any review we do. The design guidelines apply regardless of which procedure we're using.
Could I just offer an example, Mayor? Once upon a time, I think it was called Block U, there was a proposal for a suburban-style development over by the train station, like a two- or three-story building that covered the entire lot, and it was to be the future home of what we now know as Bud Clark Commons. Because of an extensive public review process, some members of the development community said to us we were nuts to a low-rise suburban-style building in an urban setting. And in fact, a good friend of Charlie's and mine on a cocktail and on a napkin at a breakfast meeting redesigned it for me. And he said, you stack it and take half the, make it an urban form building, put it on Broadway, stack it, and create a bonus lot. That bonus lot is now going to be a county health building. So we're going to have two urban form buildings. Then through that public process, some people had a concern about the color schemes and some of the discrete design elements. And they were changed to what we now have as sort of the salt and pepper look of Bud Clark Commons. Suffice it to say, there were some very, very important decisions made about the design that came from a public process, one that actually created enormous public value, because if we had eaten up the whole lot with the wrong building, we would not have had the opportunity to partner with the county on a county health department building. So I don't know how much of that came through what level of review, but I just offer that as an example that while we want to give certainty and we want to move things along, we're also building for 100 years and we want to make sure we get it right. And so I want to make sure that we have the right balance here between certainty and getting through the regulatory process and also protecting a value that Portland cares about, which is beautiful and functional.
Indeed. I think the challenge of the Design Commission, and I'm sure they'll speak to this, is that the standards to which they are charged with administering can be subjectively applied. For example, when it comes to material selection, the exterior of the building is, quote, to be of good quality material. That leaves a great deal of interpretation. In the innovative housing project conversation, they specified a 22-gauge steel exterior clad material. Design advice came back, said we'd like to see 18-gauge steel. Well, that sounds maybe like inside baseball, but that's a $395,000 difference in a project. And it really has no material effect whatsoever on what it looks like. It's the thickness of the steel in a fine-grained manner. So I think the standards themselves could be a little bit more clear, perhaps, and some materials that are currently not able to pass their design review are commonly used in the private sector, and they are commonly found throughout Portland without getting into other instances. But the project will look no different under the Type 2X project than the Type 3X.
The last question then, because I want to just make sure what's before us and what isn't before us. So the other areas where people have argued that we could get some savings would be to do things like change the rules in terms of the kinds of compensation for the workers at the site. So work with the potentially the state to alter the prevailing wage law application. Or another thing I read recently was a critique of our green building policy, and that's as being an additional cost that we could weaken. And then finally, there are some who say that the opportunity agenda for the city builds in costs because we're not building in the cheapest dirt, which is sort of the point, that we want to build in high opportunity areas in order for people to have meaningful choice. Does any of the stuff before us today address those three values?
May I address that? Because I have something that may be helpful, which my chief of staff, Tim Crail, brought to my attention. I think we should be considering these two ordinances like the tree code ordinances last week. This first one is a stopgap measure to make some immediate changes. The second ordinance directs the Bureau of Planning to go and look at all of those issues that you just mentioned, Commissioner. And I think that's what I see we're doing here. Is that correct?
Yes.
Ordinance is a stopgap. Resolution is to study it further. That's correct.
Well, and just to clarify, in September we did talk about the entire basket of social benefit costs, and BOLI, the split wage rate, sustainability, trip reduction, minority and women-owned business enterprise set-asides, the trip reduction strategies it developed in concert with PBOT with public comment. Our focus on opportunity areas, including the bedroom sizes, because we're promoting family housing at a greater cost of perhaps studio and very small micro units. So we don't intend to revisit any of those other costs in this short-term measure. In the longer-term measure, some of the issues of sustainability could come up. BOLI is a separate issue. It's a state wage rate, letter opinion of the labor commissioner. We would like to see it applied differently than it is, but I don't see that changing anytime soon.
So one of the, and I appreciate Commissioner Fritz pointing this out for me. So in the second item we're going to take up, we are directing planning sustainability to review some of these other cost drivers, kind of below the line cost drivers, and including in that is a consideration as to whether Commissioner Saltzman's green building policy will apply to affordable housing. I want to make sure I understand that.
I think it's a fair conversation to have, and we'll be happy to have that with them, yes.
Why is it a fair conversation? Doesn't it, before the council says we want to undo a policy that Dan put into law and defended for 17 years, why are we asking someone to revisit it?
Well, I don't think we're asking the Planning Sustainability, the Bureau of Planning Sustainability and the Planning Sustainability Commission to look at the mix of things that may inhibit the delivery of affordable housing. And I think the green building policy it's always been a source of debate in the affordable housing arena. And I think it's a fair debate to have. And I welcome the Planning Sustainability Commission taking a look at it.
And I don't expect, think that, yeah, and I don't then we get to say whether to change it or not.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's okay. Ultimately up to us.
All right.
One more thing to add. The resolution is written to only direct the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to amend Title 33. That doesn't deal with labor or, you know, rates of pay and all that kind of thing. It's written very broadly to remove obstacles and find ways to expedite projects that deal with mass shelters, affordable housing, and short-term housing.
I'll just say for the record, this is the first time I can remember on my watch on the council where we've said that we're going to ask someone to evaluate whether we should backtrack on our sustainability goals as to one class of housing as a way of saving money. And that's not the standard that we apply in any other setting. So that's if Commissioner Saltzman thinks it's worthy of a review, but we are setting a precedent here of saying that that the marginal cost at the front end may not be of value, even though we have generally documented long-term savings. and we're doing that in the context of an emergency, I have some concern with the council affirmatively saying that's the direction we want to go.
Well, I mean, those
are your words, Commissioner, not mine.
No.
We're asking the Planning Sustainability, Bureau of Planning Sustainability, to do an honest review, and that means nothing is off, you know, nothing is off the horizon for them to look at.
And actually, it's not the first time. The city used to have a very aggressive solar access requirement for single-family homes. It turned out to not be very cost-effective in practice, and so previous city council discarded it.
That's a bad example, Mayor.
Well, it happened. I think we're capable of learning, you know, from what works and what doesn't work.
There's
so
one difference.
Asking the question.
There's one critical difference. We're asking them to evaluate reviewing and potentially reducing standards not to for-profit housing, but to social housing. So that is a difference. We're not asking them to consider whether this is a cost burden on any other housing.
Commissioner, I think I'm confident that when they do the review that it's going to come back that, yes, indeed, it is worth the investment.
It's worth asking the question.
I have a few other yes. I believe one of the elephants in the room is that the commissioner in charge of housing is also in charge of development services, and under other circumstances, I might be concerned about that. Having seen Commissioner Saltzman and the way he manages his bureaus, I am not at all concerned that he's going to be directing his staff in development services to approve affordable housing projects just to get them done. He has a history of respecting the process, respecting the land use review, and indeed respecting his staff in development services. And so I personally am confident that he will continue to allow the staff, who I have found to be absolutely excellent in the design review section, as in the rest of development services, to do their work without interference. So I just wanted to state that on the record and thank you all for the work that you do. The second is that the Design Commission's letter says that if this ordinance passes, staff will be making final land use decisions on significant projects. As Rebecca Esau just told us, that's not the case, that these Type 2Xs are appealed to the Design Commission, so citizens would have the final say. The council would not. As was pointed out, applicants, if they prefer their chances with the City Council rather than the Design Commission, can start with the Design Commission and come to us. So it seems to me that this is an appropriate switch, at least pending hearing testimony, and also looking at it as a stopgap measure rather than something that we're enacting as a permanent basis. There's then a burden on the process and on the staff to prove that, in fact, we haven't reduced the standards or diminished the design of affordable housing in the pilot project. So that's the way I'm looking at it. My biggest concern is about the change that this change would. I was glad to see that it requires the city subsidy of at least 5 units at 60% of median family income or less. I'm wondering what's to stop a developer from going through the 2X process with the city subsector, then say, oh, never mind, I'm actually going to build luxury condos instead. And they've already got the approval for the design, and they then don't give us the affordable housing.
Well, there's currently nothing in the pipeline that fits into that category. The two instances that I mentioned, we swept our entire pipeline of projects, and those two are the only that are sort of timely and within the two areas of interest. We have nothing in Gateway at the present time, and those two others are in the central city. Looking forward, I think we'll be mindful of that potential abuse as Planning and Sustainability comes up with their recommendations to ensure.
Oh, that really doesn't.
Well, there's a clawback provision with any project that we have to be able to claw back our public funds if they have leverage those public funds for private gain. I think we would have to take an enforcement action against
them. Well, this is before they actually do it. They get the design review checked off. The building looks lovely. And then they say, well, thank you, City. I don't want the public funds. I'm going to go ahead and build luxury housing instead.
This is an easy way to do that. You can encumber the property with a lien at the outset to ensure that those a specified number of units are provided that are affordable, and
she's worried about. But
I think you're worried about the design quality question, right?
No, I'm worried about getting the design approval
right.
and then changing the project, reducing the public subsidy. What's to stop a developer from doing a bait and switch?
We'll be mindful of that risk, and we'll insure against it.
How?
We can have a regulatory agreement with the police powers of the city behind it, and we can enforce a regulatory agreement.
But they haven't gotten the approval yet.
But they would have had to have public funds in the project. And the public funds only come with the security of a development agreement, and that a development agreement can be a lien on the title. So we can claw back.
So you could put something in the development agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Help me out, development services staff. How would you then rescind the design approval if the project changes?
There's a provision in the zoning code in the 700s chapter that talks about a reconsideration, and I think it could be used for this situation where we would basically withdraw our approval of the design review because it hadn't gone through the appropriate procedure.
And what would trigger that?
When we saw a building permit that came in and we were alerted from the Housing Bureau that, they are not going to do the affordable housing they said they were going to do.
So you could have some kind of a flag within?
We have meetings now every 2 weeks with Housing Bureau staff on all of their projects and the status of all of their projects, so we're coordinating very closely.
So you're confident that you would be able to catch and then rescind the design approval?
Yes.
Great. Thank you very much.
I'm also going to offer an amendment on that 5 units after we hear some testimony from one of our design commissioners.
My final point, I just want to put on the record that the council, in the context of the comprehensive plan, has been discussing making affordable housing the public benefit for bonuses, for example. And so I want to be very clear and maybe get some head nods from my fellow commissioners. We're not making decisions on the comprehensive plan. However, we have been having significant discussions about affordable housing as a public benefit, and I want to be clear that that's partly why this is coming towards us and that is something for the Design Commission and others to consider, that that's the direction that council may be heading in the comprehensive plan.
Head nodding provided.
Thank you.
Can I pick up on Oopsie? Go ahead.
Actually, I have a couple of questions. One thing I was going to ask about the 5 units, but Commissioner Saltzman says he's going to address that. This is more related to 227 than 226, but we've already, I think all of us, asked the bureaus that engage in permitting to prioritize affordable housing. I've heard is that we've also asked them to prioritize other things like ITAP and the DOCS project, et cetera. So I think that we need to be sure that we're all telling our people in the permitting bureaus, here is what the priority ranking is, and we recognize you'll spend less time on X when you're spending more time on Y. And we should make sure that that's a consistent message throughout the bureaus because we don't want to be interpreted differently, resulting in things getting clogged that weren't supposed to. One question I have is, how transparent can we be? I mean, if you prioritize one thing, you're deprioritizing others. So how transparent can we be with the development community about saying you can expect your non-affordable housing projects to be pushed back by X weeks because of this? And one sub-question is, when we're prioritizing affordable housing, does that mean that projects that are non-affordable housing projects that are currently in the queue and have been told that you may expect that they will have the project completed within X weeks, will the affordable housing projects jump the queue so that those projects in the queue will be pushed back? So there's, sorry for the rambling question, but I think you get what I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah, I can take a stab at it. I appreciate the question and concern. It's competing priorities, and so at some point it becomes philosophical versus realistic because you can only... there's so much capacity, limited capacity. So what we've done as a solution is to add more staff and communicate the sort of priority reality that if you want to focus on ITAP, you want to focus on affordable housing, you want to focus on something else, you're trying to do it with the same number of staff, it just doesn't work. So we need to add staff. And that's been an issue with us. Fortunately, the economy is good, so we can add staff to realize those priorities. Maybe not a bureau's, that conversation needs to be had yet. I think that's part of the issue.
I would also say that call to your attention that late yesterday, Commissioner Saltzman circulated a joint memo from Director Scarlett and myself, and that very point is addressed on page 2 of that memo, which talks about the entire spectrum of process improvements that we're implementing between the two bureaus. So affordable projects will be tracked, and they will be tracked by BDS as well as Water and PBOT and Environmental Services. They all have a role to play in this processing. So we're mindful that when a decision is made to prioritize one project, and another project is given a lesser priority. Or I'm not sure that the system really allows you to then put an alert out to the next project in line to say that you'll be 3 days later than you would have been normally, as long as it occurs within the same allotted time that this council has established as a benchmark.
We might not be able to be that specific project by project, but I do think it would be useful if we tried to provide whatever information we can to the development community, saying you've heard that we're prioritizing affordable housing. You might have some concerns about what that'll mean for non-affordable housing projects. Here is what we think we can expect based on what we know now. Here is what we're tracking. We will update you on what the impact will be on you as we go along.
Yeah, that's a good point. We can pull some information together for that.
Mr. Director, going back to Commissioner Fritz's question about how do you enforce the terms of the bargain, you know, it sounded, I don't know how this quite fits, but we use regulatory agreements to ensure compliance with 60-year affordability on deals that we work on. What in this instance, what is the minimum requirement for long-term affordability that we're asking of the developer?
This is 60% of AMI, 60 years at a minimum.
Subject to a regulatory agreement?
That's correct.
And so to her question about, you know, potentially a bait and switch at some point, when do you enter into when do you enter into a regulatory agreement, and when does the design review process conclude?
Well, I think it depends on the underlying land. In both of the two examples I gave you, we have fee title to the real estate. So we still control that real estate, although we have assigned the development rights to the selected teams. So we have more leverage in those instances where we own the underlying real estate. If it's a privately owned site that we don't have fee title to, then we have to ensure that the development agreement is in place. It would normally come fairly late in the process once the final terms and conditions and the final finance is put into form. We might need an interim security instrument to avoid the sort of opportunism that Commissioner Fritz
something
has identified.
Something that, even if it's a short version, that says you understand that this benefit is being afforded to you because you've agreed to follow these terms.
Correct.
And the final agreement is going to contain a regulatory agreement with a 60-year covenant. That does have provisions for us to claw back and get damages if there's a breach. So I think her point's very well taken.
Agreed.
I guess just one other clarification, and then we'll wait to hear Dan's amendment. You said that it only applies to projects where we're affirmatively investing, so not the multi-projects. But this is not intended to allow otherwise private development just to have a lower standard of public review. So at some point, I'll be interested to know what is the right mix, the ratio of subsidized affordable units to the total package, because that seems to be the issue the two letters raise, and I think we'll look for your guidance as to what's the right mix.
We'd be happy to discuss that after the testimony.
Okay. Other questions before we take testimony? You want to save your amendment until after testimony?
Yeah.
Okay. So thank you very much. We'll call you back in a bit. Let's hear from who we have signed up to speak, please.
About seven people signed up. First three, please come on up, are Charles Johnson, Mike O'Callaghan, and Tad Savinar. Mr. Callaghan might be not. Let's go ahead and go. Oh, here he is.
Go ahead, Mr. Johnson.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name, for the record, is Charles Johnson, and I had a really live mic there for a moment.
You can move away from it a little
bit. We've talked a bit about, in previous sessions, about experimentation, and unfortunately, despite the heading of this particular proposal, we don't yet have a mass shelter proposal. I hope we will reemphasize that. I saw perhaps the most realistic number, and unfortunately, it's scrolled away. But one of these documents, one of these PDFs that's attached, talks about the thing that we never talk about enough here, and we have to admit we haven't taken enough action on. Tens of thousands of deficit units in affordable housing for people under 60% MFI. I think it was about 25,000 units short. I hope that that number will get more and more discussion, not so much here, but as we move towards an election cycle, because those people really need to know that they need to activate and support proposals like this and even more aggressive proposals so that the housing that we can move forward with housing. In Vienna, they have a better opera than we do. They also have about 30% of their city lives in public subsidized, public constructed housing. So that's just a reality. I don't know what the number is for New York, but it's something that can be done. When the city is economic and thriving, we don't just tweak the design and review process. We commit and we find ways to build the housing. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. First of all, I want to support what all these people are doing. I think it's great.
Oh, I just put your name in the record.
Mike O'Callaghan is my name. Really complex. You know, it's really interesting hearing the complexity of all the people's concern, and I appreciate that the council does that. As you know, I was involved with Right to Dream, okay, and it took us probably about 3 days to build Right to Dream. Didn't cost us any money, and we housed now 100 people, okay? This is a situation that you're in. You're very familiar with this top-down. That's just what we've been listening to with the last two groups of people who spoke. This is very different than bottom-up. Right to Dream is bottom-up. Dignity Village is bottom-up. And Hazelnut Grove is bottom-up. And they all work. I understand why you don't receive input from the bottom up. Okay, I can understand why you receive input from the top, and that's good. Great. Okay, what are you going to do? You're going to house 120 people here? Hey, great. We got 1,200, 1,600 people on the street? Good deal, 10% of them. So we need 10 times this, okay? At least 10 times. But you look at the people that are sleeping without shelter, they say 1,600, scratch a little deeper. You'll see, indeed, they didn't include 600 people in their survey because they were sleeping, because they didn't want to fill out the survey, because they didn't want to give their name. And as I've testified to the council before, we have five times that amount of people on the street, okay? You're not looking at the problem, brother. You know, we have 10,000 people on the street. Now, if you guys, if all of us were sitting outside in the rain, we would see an urgency here, and I do appreciate, Charlie, that you've stopped sweeping, pretty much, and that people are able to have some security, okay? You've created a situation that is going to not be beneficial for the community because there's no security. These people are not secure. That's why we need Right to Dreams of 25 or smaller in the community where the community invites us in. The community doesn't want to invite us in because they see the mess that's there now. Okay, they don't like it. I don't blame them. Okay, so you got choice A or B. Same way it is, mess everywhere, or do something about it. Okay, community, get on board. Okay, let's get these people in a safe place. Okay, where they can be self-determining. Let's do this. I mean, geez, be an innovator, okay? Let's try. You've got the pattern already. Pretty simple to set up. I'll work with any of you that want to do it. And I have an ad in the Tribune, okay, today, looking for 50 by 50 land where we can start a private club on. Okay, and hopefully some private property owner will respond just like the guy did down there so we could start Right to Dream. Okay, don't fight us, okay? Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Tad Savinar. I'm the vice chair of the Design Commission. Yesterday, our chair, David Wark, and myself and a member of the Landmarks Commission met with Commissioner Salzman. David Warwick had the flu, not as a result of that meeting, but he couldn't be here, so I'm reading a letter that he composed. It's been submitted to you. Interestingly enough, I think it touches on some of the issues that you've brought up, but I'll roll through it so that you have the benefit of hearing it, and then certainly can discuss some specifics as to some of the issues that you've already raised. Mayor Hills and Portland City Council, thank you for the opportunity to comment on the ordinance to allow city-subsidized affordable housing to be reviewed through a Type 2X design historic review instead of a Type 3 design historic review. The Design Commission fully supports the creation of and expediting of abundant affordable housing in our city. We recently reviewed two housing projects where we offered additional guidance, additional times to meet, and additional support for these projects to the development team. We are committed to assisting the expedient construction of affordable housing projects. However, this proposed ordinance was only shared with us last Thursday, and we would have preferred more time to have a thorough conversation about how to reach our collective goals. We believe additional work is needed to help the needs of affordable housing, such as fee breaks and a swifter and more predictable Type 3 process. Ideally, the land use process remains equal across the board for all types of projects. Affordable housing projects deserve the same level of respect and scrutiny as their neighbors. Affordable housing will be long-lasting and should be designed and reviewed with that in mind. Understanding the immediate need to move things forward, we have the following suggestions to present. One, the ordinance stipulates minimum requirements for a project in order to be able to qualify for a Type 2X procedure. The minimum number of units, 5, is not aggressive enough if the city is to overcome the crisis in which we find ourselves. Without a significant minimum threshold, there is potential for abuse. Take, for instance, the Oregon Square project, which is providing 900 housing units, 4 blocks. Under the proposed ordinance, that project would have only needed to provide 5 affordable housing units in order to avoid a Type 3 review. We request that the council revisit the minimum requirements and provide a more meaningful threshold. For instance, at least 25% of the proposed housing units of a primarily housing project must be city-subsidized affordable housing units. Two, if this ordinance passes, and this came up in your discussion, staff will be making final land use decisions on significant projects that will have aggressive construction schedules. We respectfully request council members and upper management to empower staff and to allow staff to make expert decisions based in the relevant approval criteria. Three, the ordinance requires at least one design advice review for all projects taking advantage of this incentive. The Design Commission requests that council to direct staff to establish minimum submittal requirements for these DARs. This will ensure an effective and in-depth early review by the Design Commission with predictable results. Four, if the ordinance were to be extended into October 2016, we would hope that the extension is based on factual evidence from the results of this pilot program. Thank you again for your creativity and leadership in finding ways in which to address Portland's affordable housing crisis. Please know that we are a resource to you and always willing to participate in work groups that provide guidance for legislation such as this ordinance. This is my favorite. The Design Commission is committed to supporting high-quality, low-maintenance, affordable housing where the residents are proud of their home and the neighbors are proud to have the project in their neighborhood. There's also a letter submitted from Landmarks Commission. I don't know if they're here or not, but
we have it. I don't know if there's anybody here from the commission, but we have the letter. Yes.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you for your service on the commission. I don't understand the concern about the 5 units, because if it was just 5 units in a 900 unit project, it wouldn't be getting a city subsidy.
We're concerned about something that is a Walmart with 5 units.
But it wouldn't get a city subsidy.
I think I think there's a lot of confusion about where the 5 units came from. I'm not even sure. Kurt gave one explanation, but I'm going to offer an amendment to change that to 20% of the units, just to
make it equal with
what we require on a multi-project. And it's for the two projects we're talking about that will probably take advantage of this 2X process or have the option to, they're well over 20% affordable units.
And so maybe we'll have staff back to tell us when would they give a city subsidy, because that was I shared your concern, and then I saw, well, this is a city subsidy. We're not going to give it for just a tiny amount of affordability. Thank you.
I think that's correct.
Yeah, that's a good solution. And you recommended 25%, right. Same idea.
Right.
Okay. Ed, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
The next three are Peggy Moretti, John Drentlaw, and John Zarnicki.
Come on up, please. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'd like to go first.
Should I go first?
Go ahead, please.
All right. Good morning. My name is Peggy Moretti. I'm the executive director of Restore Oregon, a nonprofit that works statewide to preserve and pass forward the historic places that create livable, sustainable communities. Restore Oregon is much attuned to and supportive of the need to retain existing affordable housing that is often the target of demolition, and we certainly support the development of additional affordable housing. There are many examples of historic buildings being successfully redeveloped into affordable housing in Portland, including most recently the Erickson Fritz apartments in Old Town, and we would love to see more of that. And in fact, one of the developers sits on our board of directors. However, we are concerned that the proposed downgrading of design review for historic properties will have significant negative consequences while having a very negligible effect on bringing new housing to market faster. I sincerely hope City Council will consider these two important points. One, what is approved during our housing emergency will outlive all of us. It will stand in our community for decades. The purpose of a Type 3 review is to ensure that what is developed respects and protects our historic buildings, is compatible with the neighborhood, and upholds standards of quality in its design and construction. Your proposal says it does not exempt compliance with historic standards or district guidelines, but an overtaxed BDS staff that is not trained in historic review, coupled with huge bureaucratic pressure to move projects forward fast, makes the likelihood of a quality Type 2 design review that pushes back when necessary seem slim. It also seems likely that the October expiration date of this emergency could be extended indefinitely. So the idea that this is a short-term one or two project proposal doesn't hold a lot of water in our mind. But more importantly, this proposal to short-circuit a thoughtful and transparent public review will only trim a whopping 9 or 10 days from the process. By the city's own analysis, a Type 3 review takes 51 to 90 days, and a Type 2 takes 42 to 80 days. This will do nothing to expedite the process in a meaningful way, but could leave the city with some very incompatible new development or mangled historic buildings that will stand for 50 years or more. What does make sense in our analysis of this and in the short time frame with which we've had to look at this and respond to it is the reduction of the fees for the different levels of review. Restore Oregon urges Council to reduce the fee structure without jeopardizing the caliber of design review.
Thank you. Thanks, Peggy. Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning. Name is John Drentlaw, and what brings me here is because of the process that is being considered. And the reason the process is of concern to me is because I'm also a vice chair commissioner for Clackamas County Planning Commission, and the city of Portland does overlay within all the tri-county area here. I think it's very important that we consider the state of Oregon planning and sustainability goals. And if we're moving from a Type 3 to a Type 2, what we are essentially doing is ignoring the number one goal of the state of Oregon, which in the first paragraph states to develop a citizen involvement program that ensures the opportunity for citizens to be involved in all phases of the planning process. And so this is ignoring that first principle. Then that is a matter of the public getting involved. Then we also talk about time and money. If we're concerned about the money and the city is investing money, it would seem like it would be a pragmatic approach to waive the additional fee that is required for these affordable housing. And when looking at affordable housing, and there was a comment brought up regarding 22-gauge exterior versus 18-gauge, affordable housing has an established history of significant deferred maintenance, and that is one of the reasons that you put a more durable surface on there so that you do not have that apparent degrading of the exterior. And that would seem like the city's investment would be very concerned about the longevity of that. And also, if you're removing the public in a process that has been established, the probability of having an appeal come up is much higher. And so, in effect, you're going to be extending the time period of this review